I'm introducing a walking tour of significant sites in Galway's theatre history. This tour was planned originally for Culture Night in association with the Galway City Museum, but it had to be postponed for what I'll call logistical reasons. I'm John Cunningham, and I work in the History Department at the University of Galway, and I organised this with my colleague Sarah Ann Buckley. Sarah Ann unfortunately can't be here, so she sends her apologies. We have 9 speakers and 9 stops, and I'll introduce each speaker as we come to their stop. Okay, standing outside the Druid Theatre in Druid Lane, formerly Chapel Lane, is Jonathan Hannon, who's finishing, I think, a PhD currently at the University of Galway. Jonathan's going to talk about Druid with a particular focus on the playwright Tom Murphy. Tom Murphy came from Tuam, as did Jonathan, and for that matter, so did I.
Thanks very much. Thanks for coming out. As John said, growing up in Tuam, Tom Murphy is like the kindly but brooding uncle at a bad wedding, if that makes sense. He was always in our consciousness. He was always there. And of course, Murphy worked extensively as a young man with the Tuam Theatre Guild. And when I was a kid, that was still flying. So that small little town, but it had a very active operatic society. It had a very active theatre culture, of which Murphy emerged from with his close friend, Noel O'Donoghue. Murphy was born in Tuam in 1936. He was born in Churchview. Interesting place because it's very, very close to the railway station. And so Murphy would have spent his life coming and going out of the train station. But the train station always represented an arrival and a process of leaving. And much of Murphy's work, early work, is very much informed by the stain and the damage of immigration to a small rural town. But essentially what he is, he's like the playwright of their typical small Irish town. But as Murphy once said in an interview with Leela Doolin in 1963, there are no characters in any of my plays that you will not ordinarily find in the town of Tuam. Now, Tuam people are intensely proud of this, but they should probably read the plays a bit closer because a lot of these characters are not particularly interesting or kindly people. So if you've all seen The Whistle in the Dark, it's a play about the famous fighting carnies. All I can say is that they were a real family. And if you stood at Murphy's front window, you were able to observe that particular family in action. There's a play for example, the play Conversations of a Homecoming. Didn't JJ take the crucifix down to the wall and throw it at his own mother? And that did happen. And so on and so forth. When he was a young boy, Murphy formed part of a group of what were called bright young fellas. Although they wouldn't have been wealthy enough to get into St. Charlotte's, they were okay enough to get into the Christian Brothers. And in there, they formed a very tight group, primarily his very close friend, Professor Michael Cooley, and Micheál Hussey. They remained friends all their lives. Anyway, this is a kind of a very common folk tale told in Tuam, and it has various different forms. And I never kind of half believed it until in 2014, I had the great opportunity to interview both Michael Cooley and Tom Murphy. And the story goes that they were enrolled in the Christian Brothers. And let's just put it this way, they were very smart, so they didn't have the shit hopped out of them every single day. But they weren't able for the violence. It was just too much for them. Back then, smart young boys like that, or if you're lucky enough to get a scholarship to go to UCG, as it was at the time, or you go to the civil service, or you join the bank, or you become a school teacher. That's what bright young boys done. Anyway, bright young boys are not supposed to go to the tech. Now we live in a technological, knowledge-driven society. It goes to show you how silly this way of thinking was. Cooley basically went over the wall and went to the tech and asked for permission to go once a week to because he didn't want to play football. And then very, very soon after, as in the following week, Murphy went with them. They went over to the tech once a week and they met a very talented teacher called Sean Cleary, who taught them how to work with their hands, how to work primarily as metal workers. Now, bear in mind that smart people are not supposed to work with their hands, or this was the way of thinking at the time. The following year, both Murphy and Cooley left and they went over the wall to the tech. They did very, very well. They would have got their group cert, as it was called at the time. And then after that, both of them were very fortunate to get a job in the sugar factory in Tuam. Now, the sugar factory was opened in 1932, Carlo Malo, Thurles and Tuam. Primarily, it went to Tuam to keep the Archbishop of Tuam quiet and to keep him happy. Bear in mind that the hierarchy were deeply mistrustful of De Valera at the time. History's complicated. When they got there, they met this very remarkable Viennese machine master called Franz Kaplan. And so this was another view of the world. This is 1948 in Tuam. This man smoked cigars. He listened to Wagner. He listened to opera. He liked to eat goulash. He taught them to stand up for themselves, how to organize collectively, how to form a union. So this was alien thinking to them. Anyway, Professor Michael Cooley taught himself to speak German fluently in 2 years. Yeah. And then he went to university in Zurich. He went to Bremen and he became a world famous professor of engineering, philosopher of technology, remarkable character. What are the chances of two of these minds in the same class at the same time? There was lots of other interesting characters there as well. Murphy left the sugar factory, became a metalwork teacher. And he said he gave it up because he couldn't deal with the power of looking out every morning and have 25 sets of eyes looking at him. So he left and went into writing full time. He was very active in the Theatre Guild at this time. There was a very progressive priest there, Father O'Brien, and they started to draw on the work primarily of Tennessee Williams, but also as well the local playwright M.J. Molloy. One night, Murphy and his best friend, Noel O'Donoghue, great character in his own right, wrote many books, stood outside the town hall and they had a brainwave. And the brainwave, Tuam was the center of music. There was 10 full-time show bands in Tuam, coming from the brass band tradition and coming from the great band leader Danny Kelly, a figure and name that appears in many of Murphy's subsequent works. That night, they sketched out the idea. That night, Murphy went home, wrote the play in one sitting, one go. And the next day, he came back to Noel. He says, Noel, I've finished. The play was called On the Outside. And it is a play about two boys that don't have the money to get into a show band. Music and lights is seen as the coming of modernity, which is quite common in theatre. Some people are on the inside of modernity and some people were on the outside. One very interesting character called the Yank Casserly kind of gives it all away when he appears with two women and a car and he leaves. So this is a critique of the coming of modernity told through music, and music is a constant theme in Murphy's work right up until the very end. His first major production was A Whistle in the Dark. And just to draw on Patricia Burke Brogan and what Lorraine was commented on, it's a secret, something that everybody knew and nobody said. So in The Whistle in the Dark, if you stood on the roof of Murphy's house, it's a crossroads. And it's a crossroads between the land that brings it back out to the bogs, out to Kilconnelly, down to there, the Badlands, the road to Galway and the road to North Galway. So his house was right in the major crossroads of the town. And in the play, there's a line, men walk with shoeboxes in the night, shoeboxes walk with men in the night. And if you want to get into the baby home or the graveyard in Tuam, the best way to do it without being seen is to cut in the back of Murphy's and go up the tracks. People still do that and people still walk on the tracks. So he left a message in that play for us all to understand. Of course, the Abbey famously rejected the play. They wrote back a rejection letter in a green pen. And it said, Mr. Murphy, these people do not exist. Of course, they do exist. They're not called carnies. They're called something else. They lived 5-minute walk from Murphy's house. But what he was getting at was the institutions. He's an anti-modernist and he's a modernist. He's a mystic and he's an anti-mystic, but he's also an anti-romantic. And the romanticism of everything that modern, that the New Ireland was, which was church, state and family, Murphy saw the hypocrisy of all these great institutions and battered them around the stage and took it apart and took it to pieces. He once said that the family is the world's most undemocratic institution. So he's getting at how family recreates forms of social reproduction. Murphy is a political writer without being agitprop. He's a sociologist without being a sociologist. And basically at the very height of his career, he was responsible for writing the Mass in English. He played a part in the translating of the old Latin Mass into English. He thought he'd find something in this. He didn't. And afterwards, he had a profound period of depression, for which he wrote a play called The Sanctuary Lamp. And this is before postmodernist theatre. There's no set. There's no stage. It's a lamp. And the lamp is God. And it's about four people talking to this lamp about what God means to them and so on and so forth. To say this caused a hurrah is an understatement. The night that it opened, let's just say, the Catholic hard right bust in from around the country. They staged a massive protest in the opening night in the Abbey. The short-lived President of Ireland, Carúl O'Doily, got onto the stage and reminded them of the night that the Abbey opened with the Playboy riots. And he added Murphy to that great canon of Irish writers. He was there to provoke people, to take a part. Now, going after institutions like the state and the family and the church, that might be very popular, even vogue now, but back in the 1970s, it wasn't. And it was at the height of his power that the Druid Theatre Company started to emerge. Druid has kind of three cycles in their history, and the first cycle is the Murphy cycle, second cycle being the Martin McDonagh cycle, and in the more recent one being Enda Walsh. All very, very different writers, but that kind of speaks more to change in Ireland than anything else. They started to work with Murphy. They were formed in 1975 as the first professional theatre company outside of Dublin. They were called the Abbey of the West, Ireland's alternative national theatre company, and so on and so forth. And really, they started to grow into their own when Murphy became a writer in residence, writer in association, big difference, in the early 1980s. He was an enfant terrible of Irish theatre, I suppose, along with the likes of Frank McGuinness, Marina Carr, and Brian Friel. But they kind of put Murphy back, Druid put Murphy back on the map as well, but he also put them very much on the map. The first major production was Balia Gan Gaire, The Town of No Laughter, which is a story about a laughing competition in Milltown. Now, there's lots of interpretation of where Murphy got this story and so on and so forth. But essentially, it's I don't know if you're familiar with the play Balia Gan Gaire, The Town of No Laughter. It's about a woman in a bed that tells the same story over and over and over again. And it's really kind of gets at Ireland's inability to let go of narrative. And this is what Tom Murphy was trying to do. It kind of formed a very long-lasting relationship. What Murphy, the zeitgeist and the problems and the hypocrisies of Irish society in the 1960s that Murphy had seen meant that those plays were directed in England. Kenneth Tynan said that he was the most violent theatre director to come on the English stage in 50 years. Many years later, when a very funny Murphy story, many years later when he was staging The Sanctuary Lamp, Kenneth Tynan could not make it to the opening night. And so he came to the second night. And Kenneth Tynan was a very famous theatre writer, worked primarily with The Guardian. And he'd gotten to know Murphy at this stage, sat down beside him. Hello, Mr. Murphy. Oh, hello, Mr. Tynan. How was your opening night, Mr. Murphy? And he said, oh, it was great. He goes, half the audience left. And he goes, and how do you feel about that? He goes, if I'm lucky, he goes, tonight the other half will go. He didn't really care that he'd pissed them all off, because what he was saying kind of had to be said. And that relationship lasted right up until 2012 and 2014, when Druid staged three Murphy plays, and the last of his plays was staged in 2014. Murphy, what Murphy gets at is narrative. It's a very famous line from the Geely concert, which was dedicated to Ivor Brown. And he said, man made God in order to make himself. And it's the idea that we create reality through narrative. And what Murphy did through a very long, controversial and very interesting career was all the great narratives that set in play our reality, he took them all apart, sometimes with a scalpel and a lot of the time with a sledgehammer. So as a Tuam Sham, we're immensely proud of Tom Murphy. And when he passed away in 2018, he rightfully took his place within the canon of great Irish writers. So it was a symbiotic relationship they had with Murphy. They were very good to him, but he also was very good to them. And Druid went on to become one of the world's most established touring theatre companies. Thank you. That's it.
In Middle Street, which as we'll see was a significant site of theatre in Galway historically, I'm introducing Mary Cunningham, who's my longtime spouse, incidentally, and also a longtime teacher in special education. Mary has an interest in oral history, and she has been making historical documentaries and podcasts. She's recording this now, so we might all end up in one of her podcasts. Mary will talk about the Racket Court Theatre in Middle Street and its connection with the writer Walter Machen.
Okay, thanks, John. So we're standing outside Milano's restaurant, and this is the site of the Racket Court Theatre, which I'm going to talk about. just to be accurate, it's just this part of Milano's, the part that's covered in black here on this side, is the actual site. Now, this Racket Court Theatre was an important centre for popular entertainment from the mid-19th century to the 1920s. In a directory in 1846, we can see mention of a racket court and that it was also attached at that time to two billiard rooms. And again, it's clearly marked in the 1872 Ordnance Survey map. For the decade of the 1850s, it was called the Eglinton Racket Court, after the Earl of Eglinton, Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, who had a lot of things named after him in Galway. A canal, a street, a cricket club, public baths and a hotel. The building changed hands several times, as did the activities that went on inside. It was re-roofed in 1875, and possibly at that point other alterations were made. In 1889, it's recorded as the Racket Court Theatre. Now, there's an ad in the Connacht Tribune in 1920, which indicates that the premises is up for sale, and the owner at that time is Mrs. Eileen O'Shaughnessy. And we can see from the ad that it was a substantial premises. It comprised of a 500-seat theatre, complete with the stage and proscenium arch, two bars, two billiard rooms, a lavatory, and a sizeable yard with stables. The entertainment in it ranged from plays and concerts. The tenor John McCormack performed here in 1909. There were also boxing matches, and obviously the billiards as well attracted young men and university students. There's an account in the Freeman's Journal in 1908 of a fracas that broke out between the students and other members of the audience when they came to see a boxing match. And one of the boxers failed to turn up. The disgruntled students started firing chairs onto the stage, and others joined in initially, but later the crowd turned on the students and chased them down through the streets. Now, it seems it all ended up peacefully enough, and no arrests were made. Now, a significant event here was the showing in Galway of the first moving picture in 1897. No doubt a huge crowd came to this because it would have been quite a phenomenon at the time. And films became a regular feature. From October 1911, they were showing a film every day. And looking again at maps, it seems a section of the theatre was given over to being operated as a cinema. So it was the first cinema in the town. Now, in relation to plays, Lady Gregory was closely connected with this place, and she had a lot of her plays staged here in the first decade of the 1900s. She also arranged for the staging of Synge's Riders to the Sea in 1908. The Irish Literary Theatre, later the Irish National Theatre Society, founded by Gregory, Yeats and Edward Martin, visited here with productions such as Catalina Houlihan and other plays which were part of the cultural revival. Other touring performers came, so there was just a huge variety of events going on here. Now, as well as the theatre aspect, it was a venue for meetings. The inaugural meeting of the Galway Workers and General Labourers Union was held here. Meetings organised by the Galway Women's Suffrage Society met here, along with other organisations. Now, Eileen O'Shaughnessy, who I mentioned just there in relation to the ad in the Tribune. She was the owner in 1920, and she was the daughter of Thomas Power from Ballinasloe. He was a sergeant major in the British Army in India when Eileen was born, and then he was posted to Galway, so Eileen grew up here. She married a Peter O'Shaughnessy, who is listed as the lessee of the Racket Court and the billiard rooms in 1902. Now, by all accounts, she had a good head for business, and also her sisters were talented singers and musicians. So the Power family were well suited to marry into the theatre business. Peter O'Shaughnessy died in 1910, and that left Eileen with three children, I think maybe more, I'm not sure. In 1901, the census records them as having three children. They were living in Ely Place, and they had seven boarders in the house.
Two of those boarders were Eileen's cousins from Ballinasloe, Agnes Brady and her sister Nora. They'd come in to give her a hand in the house, help with the children, while Eileen was busy running the business. I suppose this is where we get to part two of the story, and we could call it the Racket Court Theatre, where love stories begin. Agnes was at first working in the house, but later she came to help out in the bar, and she caught the eye of Walter Stephen Macken, who had come to Galway in 1904. He was born in Cong in 1888. His father was the chief forester on the Ashford Castle estate, and his mother was the cook, and they lived in an estate house. All was going well until the father died suddenly and the family was evicted and left destitute. In 1897, Walter Stephen and his brother Michael were charged with begging, and they were sent to the industrial school in Letterfrack, and later their two younger brothers ended up in the same institution. Walter left when he was 16 and he was trained at this stage as a carpenter. He got a job with Emerson Builders. His grandson, Ulton, reports that he was known as a talented singer and actor and was very handsome. So he performed at amateur theatre groups and helped building sets. Shows were often put on in the Augustinian Hall down the street here. It was known locally as Father Crotty's Hall. And after a performance, the punters and the actors would come to the Racket Court for drinks. Also, he was involved in union activities, and this would have brought him to the Racket Court as well. So he took a fancy to Agnes and asked her out. At first, she rejected him. Ulton speculates that it was because she was older than him and felt that maybe it wasn't a suitable match. He persuaded her to go out with him in any case, and they married in 1911. He was 22 and she was 28. They lived in Eyre Square at first, but then they got a council house, number 19, St. Joseph's Terrace. And many of you would be familiar with the house because it has a plaque on it indicating that this is where Walter Macken, the writer, was born. They had two girls, Eileen and Nora, and then the boy, Walter, who was born in 1915. And a few months after his birth, his father was let go from Emerson's. So to provide for the family, he joined the British Army to fight in the war. And Walter Macken, his son, reflects the kind of dilemmas faced by his father and men like him who signed up to fight for the British Army. This is fictionalised in his novel, The Scorching Wind. Walter was killed on March 28, 1916. Now, his letters to Agnes reveal a good deal about his personality and his abilities. They're all well written and they're descriptive of his surroundings and experiences in the trenches. And his longing for home and family is palpable in these letters. In almost every one, he asks for Mrs. O and the gang at the Racket Court. Ulton tells us that his grandmother was a brilliant storyteller, so it's no surprise that her son Walter was good at it also, and that he had a flair for acting, given his father's talents, and also his cousins on his mother's side were talented musicians and actors, as I mentioned before. We'll hear a little bit more about Walter when we have the talk on the Tyvearc. As for the Racket Court Theatre, it didn't sell in 1920. It made the papers in 1923 for illegal betting happening on the premises. Mrs. O is still in charge at this stage. By 1927, she's passed away. The executor of her will, Mary Stanford, is directed by the courts to pay £30 in rent arrears to Colonel Bernard of the Kirwan family, who were based out in Castle Hackett near Tuam. It appears that it ceased to function as an entertainment centre following Mrs. O'Shaughnessy's death. Jane Stanford, a descendant of Mary Stanford, says that it was part of it was used at one point as a bicycle repair shop. Jim Higgins, the Galway City Council heritage officer, tells us that it was used by the corporation as a storage yard. So that basically brings us to the end of the story of the Racket Court Theatre.
A few doors down from the site of the Racket Court Theatre, we come to Ontiveyearc, and I'm about to introduce Janine Woods. But before I do, I'll mention an earlier site of theatre in Middle Street, which is referred to in Hardiman's History of 1820. According to Hardiman, the assembly room in Middle Street frequently displays an assemblage of native beauty, elegance and fashion, which would grace the drawing room of any court. Hardiman doesn't state where these rooms were, and they don't appear in the Ordnance Survey map of 1839. Given the reported amenities, the probability is that it occupied the site of the Racket Court, which was there already by the mid-1840s, as we've heard. There were certainly public entertainments in the assembly rooms, quasi-theatrical entertainments from magicians, astronomers. There were popular science lectures, and there were the scientists, I suppose, some of them were creating spectacle with electricity. Monsieur F. Testo was described as the ne plus ultra of the cabalistic art, and he performed here in the 1820s. Cabalistic, I don't know. I think it means relating to the Kabbalah, the ancient mystical Hebrew text. So moving on to introduce Janine then outside the Ontiveyearc is Kolyaki Lomsa I Janine in Olskol Nagalva Ochi Willa in an Lechtor Iren Nagalga. So Janine on Ontiveyearc.
So yeah, Ontiveyearc na Gaillimhe, Orclan Náisiúnta na Gaeilge, the National Irish Language Theatre. It was established here in 1928, but talks have been going on for a few years and discussions at that stage about the importance of setting up a National Irish Language Theatre. And Ernest Bligh, or Ernan de Blyde, he was the Minister for Finance in the Common Ungheil government over those years, and as it happened, he was both a revivalist and a theatre enthusiast, so he awarded £600 of a grant for this project, which was no small sum at the time. Galway was chosen as the location, the obvious location for this National Irish Language Theatre, because of the proximity to the country's largest Gaeltacht, where Irish is spoken as community language, and also because of UCG, as it was then, which had gave special recognition to the language. So the first thing to do was to find the location. And as Mary said there, this was the location that was found. There was a parish hall owned by the Augustinian fathers here, the Father Crotty's Hall. And the Augustinians agreed to rent this for the project, for the Gaelic National Theatre, as it was being called, on the condition that it wasn't used for dances. But apparently Cayleys didn't count in that, because they set up a committee to run Cayleys once they established Ontiveyearc. So a committee was looking after the establishment and the setup and the running. And there were some tensions within the committee between, in terms of the creative vision that they had for Ontiveyearc. Two of the big figures, Dr. Seamus O'Byrne, who was a native Irish speaker from Joyce Country in North Connemara, he felt that the Ontiveyearc should be staging plays that were based on folk motifs and, you know, traditional indigenous Gaeltacht themes, really. And Professor Liam O'Brien, who was a professor of Romance languages in the university, he favoured staging translations of modern European plays. So this tension between what should be staged should be original plays, original Irish language plays or translations, kind of recurs a bit throughout the history of Ontiveyearc. So they got the premises. So the next thing was to find a director. And they needed a director who had the requisite theatrical skills, but also who had Irish, which was not an easy job. But they came upon Micheál MacLiamore. They were lucky enough to come upon MacLiamore, who was a London-born, Dublin-based actor and also an Irish language and culture enthusiast. So MacLiamore agreed, and he came down. And on the 28th of August, 1928, the Ontiveyearc opens with its first play, which is Diarmuid Agus Gráinne, based on a Fenian story, Scéal Fíneachta. And the play was written, designed and directed by McLeamore. And it was a great critical success, particularly for its lavish design. And McLeamore was successful, but he and his partner Hilton Edwards were also working at the time on setting up the Gate Theatre studio in Dublin, which became the Gate Theatre. So McLeamore was really torn between the two. He was commuting between Galway and Dublin, and he continued that into 1929, but it wasn't really sustainable for anybody. McLeamore and Edwards agreed to train up his successor, and that successor was Frank Dermody, who was an actor here in Antaibhearc. He was also a corporal in Anchéad Cha, that was the Irish-speaking battalion of the army in Renmore Barracks. And so Dermody went up to Dublin. He trained under McLeamore and Edwards, and he came back here as director in 1931. And McDermody had a successful run. He was here for 7 years and moved on to the Abbey. And he was succeeded then by Walter Macken, the son, who had been working in England as a theatre manager and director. And so Walter Macken comes and takes over here in 1939. And Walter Macken has a very successful run. He does 8 years. And in those 8 years, he oversees 97 productions, which is huge. And 76 more plays, which is some feat. But he resigned in 47. I think he was a bit fed up with the tensions that were going on between translation versus original Irish language. And, you know, there's a lot of politics and a lot of personalities, as we can imagine. Macken resigned. And then it's in his place, Ian Priestley Mitchell comes in. And one of the, I suppose, under Priestley Mitchell, one of the high points, if you like, was the staging of Saint Siobhan here in 1950, which was a translation of George Bernard Shaw's Saint Joan. And it was translated and co-directed and by Siobhan McKenna, who also starred. She had the leading role, who, of course, Siobhan McKenna goes on to have a very long and illustrious career in theatre and film, as do a lot of people who come from Antaibhearc. A lot of the members of Antaibhearc over the years, Padraig Lam, Edna Lydon, Mick Lally, just to name a few. So the Antaibhearc does manage to, you know, despite the tensions, it really combines staging of original Irish language productions and translations over the decades. One of the notable productions, I suppose, the originals was An Triail by Mairéadh Ní Graoda in 1968 for its 40th anniversary. An Triail is well known now because it's on the Leaving Cert, I think, curriculum, but it was really radical both formally and in terms of its subject matter, which, as Jonathan was mentioning, dealing with a lot of the hypocrisies in Ireland. It's dealing with, you know, pregnancy outside of marriage, single motherhood, prostitution, and really the hypocrisy of the society, of Irish society, in face of those kind of questions. In 1971, Alan Simpson was director of that stage, and he oversaw a staging of Ag Fanachtar Godot, a translation of Beckett's Waiting for Godot. And Tom Kenny, he was one of the cast, he's purported to have sent the tape of the production to Beckett, who is supposed to have thought it was wonderful. So it got the authorial stamp of approval there. So in 1977, Antaibhearc buys the building. They buy the building over from the Augustinians, and it's renovated and it's reopened in 78. For its 50th with a play by Christopher O'Flynn. Clehi Clownish, it was written, commissioned for the opening. Christopher O'Flynn just died a couple of weeks ago, sadly. There was a serious fire in 2007, which does a lot of damage to the building. So Antaibhearc, the building closes for a number of years, but Antaibhearc continues to stage productions around Galway, in Druid Lane, where we've just left, and Black Box and other places around. And it's reopened by Michael Dee in 2012 and has been going pretty much ever since. Antaibhearc stages Irish language plays as part of the Galway Arts Festival. That's one of the kind of staples now. In 2020, the management of Antaibhearc was taken over by Feebean, a Galway-based theatre company coming from Connemara. And Feebean is in situ here at managing Antaibhearc up to the present day. So it's fast approaching its centenary, and it's really played an important role in the development of Irish language drama and, you know, in the story of theatre in Galway throughout, I think, really. So, Gamara Sin Chéad. Okay, Gramada, thanks.
Our speaker on Spanish Parade is Gary McMahon. Gary works for Galway City Council and he presents the Arts, Culture and Entertainment show on Galway Bay FM. In a previous incarnation, Gary graced the streets and the stage with Máchnas, and he's going to talk now for a few minutes about Máchnas.
Hello, how are you? I'm Gary McMahon, as John introduced me. I used to work in Máchnas a long time ago. I stopped working there about 23 years ago. I was involved I'd say half the people here, because Paddy Noonan just told me he was one of the three in a row heads in Castlebar in 1987, which was Mopnes's first big day out. I know I'm teaching my grandmother how to suck eggs, but Mopnes are a performance and theatre company based in the community, based in Galway City, who have been on the go since approximately 1986. One thing happened in 1984 and another thing happened in 1985, which weren't Mopnes at all. 1984, Ronald Reagan came to Galway in a special visit and he was given an honorary degree in the Quad in college. And Mickey Gorman has a brilliant poem about the sewers being searched in advance. But there was a big protest by basically the alternative Galway as it would have been at the time. And there was the protest was confined to Cathedral Square in front of where the VEC have their offices there. On the site of the old jail, which some of the people probably would have intended that most of us would have ended up in. But anyway, among the people involved in the organisation that were people like Tom Conroy, who was an artist, Pete Salmon, who was a community artist and had been involved in various theatre things based in Dublin. Pádraig Branaigh was knocking around, and Ollie Jennings was involved in the Arts Festival, as had been from the very beginning in Arts Fest. And they did, there was a protest, but there was elements in it. There was built elements, and there was rockets, and there was a facsimile of the Statue of Liberty and all that sort of stuff. So it wasn't really particularly organised, but it was a sort of a slightly artistic and alternative rabble, for want of another thing. The following year, 1985, that building didn't exist. That used to be, for the Galway people here, many of whom I spot, that was McDonough's fertiliser place. And that had fallen into ruin and disuse by 1985. And it was, the preparation was there to start the development that would become Jury's Hotel, now Leonardo's Hotel. But it was a series of all sorts of things. And down here had been the corporation offices that were along here. Obviously here, Comfort House was the old museum. But what actually happened is Els comedians from Catalonia were invited over by the Arts Festival to do two shows, an outdoor show called The Devils and an indoor show called Alle or Breath, which was done in Leisureland. Thereby hangs another tale. It was, you're laughing because you know the nudity and the tickets weren't going very well. And suddenly Bridie O'Flaherty was informed of the nudity in Leisureland and a petition was got up and tickets flew out the door. These two facts have no correlation whatsoever, I swear. According to her daughter, the councillor Terry O'Flaherty, she said it had absolutely nothing to do with ticket sales. But anyway, so Els comedians were there. But Els comedians took what was basically a ramshackle old place and with minimal light and with a lot of firecrackers and smoke and a bit of and a lot of imagination, screaming, roaring and drums, put on a show. And that provided a huge inspiration to the people who came together to form Mopnes. In 1986, the first kind of Mopnes parade came down the town during the Arts Festival. Combined with that, Footspar and Theatre Company had been coming to Galway for years, still can come to Galway, and they performed in tents and in informal spaces, but they also always did a kind of a parade type thing to publicise their shows. And the people involved, they became very friendly with a lot of the people involved in the Arts Festival, a lot of people involved in all sorts of other things, and they provided a certain amount of inspiration as well. So these things came together in 1986 and the first Mopnes Parade. 1987, there was a funding application went to the Gulbenkian Foundation and Mopnes were successful, steered by Kieran Benson, who eventually ended up as the chair of the Arts Council. And they got the first funding and their first mission statement was to perform and have fun on a grand scale. That was the mission statement. And that led to two different things, creating a dragon, which another tale hangs, and the creation of the Galway Three in a Row team of the 60s, heads that were made. They weren't papier-mâché and they weren't fiberglass. They were some other toxic thing. I don't know what it is, Paddy, but they were completely toxic with the materials that were made from. And they went to Castlebar and Connacht GAA actually agreed to have them. And they did a parade through the town of Castlebar and they went out and paraded around like the thing with a band, whatever. And then there was a mock football match, which was largely scripted by Pádraig Branaigh and Mickey Gorman, to my recollection. And it did all the things. The referee was blind, the cardinal throwing in the ball, all sorts of things. The fellow having his jersey pulled and it turned out his sleeve was, you know, kind of about 50 metres long. That, all those gags. the reason we picked here is, one, because it's close to the museum, but two, 1989, when the first big Mockness parades of Tír Fuí Chon, the land beneath the waves, which is basically starting then to take Irish stories from myth and legend. Tír Fuí Chon is linked with the Tuatha Dé Danann, the defeat of the Tuatha Dé Danann by the Milesians or whatever, but basically it's about a land beneath the sea. And the premise of the story of the parade, and the parade always has a story, was that Manannán MacLir, the ruler of that land beneath the waves, made his way through Galway, and he was coming to here because he was getting married to a human bride who was from the Cladda. And there was a procession, and she with her father came on a horse-drawn trap, and they came across and they came here. The wedding ceremony was here, which was great crack, because Rod Goodall was a shaman and he took on the priest played by Pete Salmon within sight of the Cladda church, and it was brilliant. There was a shoal of fish, a shoal of mackerel, which was actually the Shantala school of mackerel. It was Shantala school because in the year before, 1988, Mockness had done Gulliver. So Mockness starts doing these theatre shows, which are both popular and they're critically acclaimed as well, and then start moving indoors. In 1992, Mockness was invited to do a theatre show at the World Expo in Seville, in Spain. And they devised a show. And if you look up Irish playography, which I did today, see, I did research, it's credited as being written by Pádraic Branach. But it actually, if you read down into it, it says devised by the cast. And they're devised performances. So there was a series, Thorn, Sweeney, the story of Mad Sweeney the King, Balor of the Evil Eye, and those three, the Celtic shows. And they went indoors, but there was very little, if any, spoken word in them. They were always driven by music, and they were always driven by physical theatre in terms of doing. And then moving on through the 90s, Rhymes of the Ancient Mariner, which was at the opening of the Black Box out in the Dyke Road, devised by Tricia Ford and Rod Goodall. Following year, Diamonds in the Soil, which is a show based on the life of Vincent van Gogh, was also done in the Black Box. And the last show that I was involved with in 2000, which was out in Leisureland during the Arts Festival, was The Lost Days of Ollie Deasy, which was a retelling of the story of Odysseus, and who was Ollie Deasy, and the search for him by his son, not Telemachus, but Terry, or Tel, who was a hurling player. And it was taking out, you know, the Balor of the Evil Eye was a tractor with just one headlamp on it. Or not Balor, the Cyclops. Then Mockness also got involved with the Arts Festival, doing a production of The Dead School, Pat McCabe's novel, which he adapted for the stage with Mick Lally in the lead role as Gabriel, the old teacher. Mockness then stopped more or less doing theatre. They were to revive it, and they were going to do a multimedia, indoor, outdoors, across all sorts of media of theatre in 2020, which was Gilgamesh. And of course, we know what happened with 2020, and it didn't actually come about. But that was scripted by Marina Carr, but obviously involving all sorts of... So this combination of performance, of a lot of devised work and script writing in it, in different spaces. And Mockness has brought that all over the world, and they've done it for, you know, kind of in just pure mad crack places, and also done it in places like 30 years ago this year. Mockness went on tour with U2 on the Zoo TV, to European leg of the Zoo TV, which is being celebrated in Vegas. They never asked us, they never called, you know, we're still waiting in terms of doing it. But Mockness still is doing that. Mockness rediscovered its ambition to produce indoor theatre a couple of years ago. But I am led to believe that the powers that be, and we realise I'm being recorded, who have offices in Merrion Square, say, no, you're an outside physical performance street spectacle company. You don't do theatre. And they're kind of going, we do. And it is theatre. Thorn and Sweeney, I think it was Thorn and Sweeney, both but won Best Irish Productions at the Dublin Theatre Festivals that they were performed at. They brought Balor to a World Theatre Festival in Colombia when it was neither popular or profitable to go to Colombia. They had to bring Balor. They couldn't bring Sweeney because Sweeney was so strongly anti-clerical. They said, no, the theatre will be burnt down if you go up that badly against the Catholic Church. So Mockness always stood for something. And although it seems like great crack, and it will on Sunday week with the Cnova La Loba, which is the new Mockness parade, first one in 4 years on the streets. But there is always a narrative. There's always a story. It is theatre. And I'll stop now. Well done.
Here, facing the site associated with the Punchbag Theatre Company, I'm introducing Lorraine Grimes. Lorraine, formerly of the University of Galway and currently of the University of Maynooth, is going to talk about Punchbag, which was founded in 1989. She's going to focus in particular on the playwright Patricia Burke Brogan, who died last year.
Thanks, John. So Punchbag Theatre Company was set up in 1989. It was inspired by The Druid, which was established in 1975, and the Galway Arts Festival in 1978. And according to Lionel Pilkington, Punchbag set out to combine the performance of contemporary Irish plays with new and commissioned drama that had a strong social justice element. Its two patrons were playwright Tom Murphy, chosen because of the group's admiration for his plays, and Bishop Eamon Casey, chosen for his work as a social justice campaigner. So Punchbag was Galway's second English language professional theatre after Druid, and Punchbag used pubs, school halls, and a former renovated garage for their theatre space. Finance was a problem for the company, but Punchbag rented and renovated the Old Castle Motorworks in the late 80s and the early 90s, and occasionally incorporated the old mechanics pit into their performances. Punchbag's performance choices canvassed issues relating to social justice, such as Rita Ann Higgins' God of the Hatchman, a play about the experience of being unemployed in Galway. And in October 1992, performed Patricia Burke Brogan's play Eclipsed. Patricia Burke Brogan worked in Galway Magdalen Laundry in Foster Street in the early 60s as a novice nun with the Sisters of Mercy. During her time there, Patricia became emotionally conflicted about her vocation after witnessing the cruel treatment of women within the laundry. She confronted the mother superior about the conditions and the treatment, but she did not receive any sympathy or understanding. And Patricia recalls that she vomited after that encounter with the mother superior. And it was from here she knew that she had to leave the congregation. So years later, Patricia wrote the play Eclipsed, exposing the treatment she had witnessed in Galway Magdalen Laundry. Patricia wrote the play in the 1980s, after leaving in the 1960s, early 1960s. The play initially was rejected by numerous theatre companies until Punchbag agreed to do a trial performance in November 1991. It was an instant success, and she signed a two-year contract with Punchbag. The play has had an enormous effect on the conversation around Ireland's institutional past and has won numerous awards. Patricia Burke Brogan, an artist, a poet and a playwright, exposes the punishing conditions of the Magdalen Laundry. Punchbag ended when the company did not receive sufficient funding from the Arts Council to keep going. Lionel Pilkington states that Punchbag ended more or less at the same time as the period of Ireland's accelerated economy of low taxation, capitalisation, light-touch financial regulation and the privatisation of public services. So that was the end.
In Kirwan's Lane, we hear from Brendan O'Mahony. Brendan was a long-time teacher of history and French, and he has a deep interest in the history and culture of the West of Ireland. He's going to talk about the late 18th century theatre in Kirwan's Lane and about Wolfe Tone's association with it.
Okay, John, thanks. Hello, everybody. Ye woods and wilds whose melancholy gloom accords with my soul's sadness and draws forth the voice of sorrow from my bursting heart, farewell a while, I will not leave you long, for in your shades I deem some spirit dwells, who from the chiding stream or groaning oak still hears and answers to Matilda's moan. Oh, Douglas, Douglas, if departed ghosts are e'er permitted to review this world, within the circle of that wood thou art, and with the passion of immortals hear'st my lamentation. Hear'st thy wretched wife weep for her husband slain, her infant lost, my brother's timeless death I seem to mourn. Who perished with thee on this fatal day, to thee I lift my voice, to thee address the plaint which mortal ear has never heard. O disregard me not, though I am called another's now. My heart is wholly thine, incapable of change. Affection lies buried, my Douglas, in thy bloody grave. Now, these were the first lines of Douglas, which is the play that was staged here in August 1783. The play Douglas was a very famous, very well-known play at the time, written about 30 years before, a Scottish play, and it was one of the mainstays of theatre in Britain in the 1700s, right into the 1800s. So it was performed in Britain, it was performed in America, a very famous play. It was the first play performed here in this theatre, Martin Theatre, as it's called here. And I suppose that in itself was an event, but when we see the actual people who performed in the play is what makes it even more memorable. The play was regarded with great pride in Scotland. Many people felt it was, in Scotland, felt it was comparable to Shakespeare. Now, this was not acknowledged outside of Scotland, but still. And it was used in schools right up to the Second World War as a text in Scottish secondary schools. The other piece was All the World's a Stage, which was a farce, and as you can imagine, was probably needed after, because Douglas was a tragedy in five acts, and as you can gather from the opening few lines, very tragic it was indeed. It was based on an epic poem. Now, Richard Martin established this theatre in 1783. He bought the building and he set up the theatre. The theatre inside was cramped. It said on the actual poster that still remains, it's there in the window here, ladies were recommended that they do not wear hoops, which implies that it was very crammed inside. There were perhaps about 100 people attended the play. Richard Martin was of the great, the important Martin family, one of the tribes of Galway. The Ballinahinch estate in Connemara, which was huge, hundreds of thousands of acres. And at the time he was living in Dangan, which is the university grounds out by the river Corrib. Now, Martin had been sent to school in England, and to Harrow in England. He went to Cambridge University. He didn't finish there, but he went there. Came back to Ireland, went to America at the time when America was struggling for independence, and then back to Ireland, where he entered the Irish Parliament at the age of 22. Now, he took the Patriot side of the Parliament. He was a supporter of Grattan and later of Flood. And one of the driving policies that he pursued right through his life was that of Catholic emancipation, the ending of the penal laws that remained, and that Catholics have equal rights with Protestants. There are some famous nicknames he had, and they seem to be kind of quite contrasting. One is Trigger Martin, or Hair Trigger Dick, because he was famous for fighting duels, and he must have been made people slightly uneasy in his company, but he fought with the sword and with the pistol. And I've seen read a few times that he fought up to 100 duels. Now, I find that very hard to believe myself. But now, the other nickname accredited to him seems a huge contrast, because it's Humanity Dick, Humanity Martin. And apparently he was a very, very kind man. And it was people observed from many sources that, in particular, people who were in difficult circumstances, people who had no money, or who were, you know, some misfortune had fallen upon them, and that right through his life he seems to have gone out of his way to help them. Many of them he brought to live in his own house. Many of them were in Ballinahinch, and it was actually the Prince Regent of England who came up with the name Humanity Martin, which then became Humanity Dick. So this was the Richard Martin who established the theatre here He was himself an actor. He was very interested in the theatre. He had been acting in Dublin. He was a very confident man. He was very witty, very humorous. So the theatre possibly came naturally to him. And theatre was very popular at the time, and certainly amongst his class. Now, when he was 23, in 1777, the year after he entered Parliament, he married Elizabeth Vesey from Dublin, I think Lucan House, but whose family had come from Hollymount in Mayo. By all accounts, a very attractive, beautiful, vivacious young woman, very artistic, a painter, a writer, but her real passion was acting. And it was she who she played the role of Lady Randolph in the play here, and reviews exist of her performances, and she is compared very favourably with many famous, the most famous actors in Britain at the time. So she was a woman of many, many talents. Now, the third person who graced the stage here, who is also very famous, of course, is perhaps the most famous of all, one of the most famous people in Irish history, Wolfe Tone. When Richard and Elizabeth were in Dublin, they made the acquaintance of Wolfe Tone in social circles. Wolfe Tone was an actor himself. He was very interested in theatre. In 1782, he had fallen into difficulty because he had been a second in a duel in which a fatality occurred. I think he was suspended from Trinity College, which he was attending. And in any case, it was convenient for him to leave Dublin. Martin, as was his wont with many people, came in to help out. He invited him down to Galway, and so he came to Dangan as tutor to Richard's two half-brothers who were teenagers. Now, Dangan is a beautiful grounds down by the Corrib. Richard, Martin appears to have been away a lot. Elizabeth was very beautiful, very attractive. Young Wolfe Tone, who was only 20, was full of passion and enthusiasm and fell madly in love with Elizabeth Martin. Apparently, in time, this was reciprocated. So when this drama was taking place, already you can imagine the emotions of the first night of the play, but I don't know, I think it would have been a great occasion to have attended. And of course, Wolfe Tone acted as Lord Randolph. Richard was on stage as well as Lord Glenalvin. So what happened in the end? They were all so young then. Richard lived a very long life. He died at 80 years of age. Many things happened to him right through his life. Most famously, he was the main mover in the founding of the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And the legislation that he pushed through was the first legislation anywhere in the world that protected animals. However, Elizabeth and he did not stay together. While in France, well, maybe I'll come to Wolfe Tone first. He got out of the picture fairly early because for a completely nothing to do with his affair with Richard's wife, which luckily for Wolfe Tone, Richard knew nothing about, they fell out for another reason and Wolfe Tone left and of course went on and we know to eventually die in a British jail or in jail in 1798, having been one of the main movers in the 1798 rebellion. Elizabeth and Richard were in Paris during the French Revolution. Richard again was away a lot, and Elizabeth met up with a man called Petrie, an Englishman, and went off with Petrie, had an affair with him. A divorce happened. Richard sued for divorce, was granted £10,000 in court, and Elizabeth went to live with Petrie in Kent, had two children with them, and they stayed together all their lives. To finish off, I might say some of the words that Wolfe Tone said, seeing as we think of him back there 240 years ago. So this was Lord Randolph, and it was Wolfe Tone in here who was articulating these sentiments. "Yet this distinguished dame invites a youth, the acquaintance of a day, alone to meet her at the midnight hour. This assignation the assassin freed, her manifest affection for the youth might breed suspicion in a husband's brain, whose gentle consort all for love had wedded, much more in mine. Matilda never loved me. Let no man after me a woman wed, whose heart he knows he has not. Though she brings a mine of gold, a kingdom for her dowry, for let her seem like the knight's shadowy queen, cold and contemplative. He cannot trust her. She may, she will, bring shame and sorrow on him, the worst of sorrows and the worst of shames. Okay, Sinead.
Well, we're in Bowling Green, opposite the home, or former home, of Nora Barnacle. And here I'm introducing our next speaker. Is Kolyak Ilyam Eokulyan in Olskal na Galiva, as Laurel Shefwi Nafomiha, Compontus Arklana in a Roshefain Lorna, Sinopadi.
Well, standing outside number 3 Bowling Green, right across from the Nora Barnacle House, and looking at the mural on the wall, which says the new absence is probably in the Fáinne, who existed in Galway and who grew from the Cumann Dromaíochta in 1987. I came to town in 1986, and in the maths class, under the stewardship of Greek mathematician Dr. Tony Christofides, who always came to see our plays thereafter. We met. We were Irish-speaking in a natural way. We had no nationalistic reasons for speaking the language. It was the natural thing to do. It was as natural as the actors who were in Druid down in Chapel Lane spoke English at the time to each other. And I think it's also important to make the point that there are over 70 languages spoken on this island, and we rarely hear any of their ideas expressed in theatre. And that might be food for thought for the large gathering here in Bowling Green this evening. But anyway, from the Cumann Dromaíochta in 1986, a play, The Odd Couple by Neil Simon, directed by the political correspondent of the Irish Times these days, Harry McGee. And after Christmas, Maureen Inigo-Vaughan from West Kerry and I took a 1972 script by English playwright David Compton, Us and Them, translated as Shinne Agus Id Siúd, and we went to the National University's Drama Festival and took a prize with it. And buoyed up by that, O'Clarty and I said we should leave the university behind, leave our courses. I was doing a BSc, he was doing a BCom. He had a better head for figures than I had. And we decided, rather than go and tell our parents that with not even 1 year complete we were going to leave, that we should visit the Irish colleges throughout the country, and we'd have a chance of making some money there while performing theatre for the students. That we did. We travelled nearly 2,000 miles and performed to nearly 3,000 students. And the 5 members of Na Fáinne, Trevor O'Clarty, Maureen Inigo-Vaughan, Columba Tierney and Jack Nyargasa, and I left that summer with £500 each in our pockets. So theatre wasn't a bad thing when we were able to go home and say we had made a few bob from it. In 1988, another friend of ours, Eamon O'Nochtan from Salt Hill, had completed a course in theatre direction in the Abbey Theatre, a very promising young director at the time. He got hold of a script by Micheál MacLiomer, which was first performed in The Gate in 1948. The mountains look different. Tá Cumann nua ar na sléibhte. And we got permission to use the sitting room of Lady Gregory's townhouse in 45 Domnick Street, a very historic building and very symbolic because Lady Gregory is really the mother of Irish arts, if you like, and moreover of the Irish theatre, and probably doesn't get enough credit for that, probably because she was the wrong sex, dare I say. But anyway, we performed that during that summer. We converted the front room into a small theatre. Higgins's and Munster Avenue gave us some metal tubes to hang our lights. Cars Paints, over where Supermax is today, gave us free paint. Irish Salmon Producers group in Kilchiron in Connemara gave us loads of smoked salmon, even though we weren't smoked salmon socialists. It did keep us going for a while because we had little enough income, but we did fill the house, a tiny theatre, 45 seats maybe. We filled the theatre for a week and then went on a tour of the country, including the Aran Islands, on a very small budget, if you like. The company managed to produce up to 20 plays in the course of its five-year existence from 1987 until it disbanded in 1993. There was no production in 1993. The productions ceased with a visit to Seville to Expo 92 in August of that year. We were invited to perform and we chose a novella by Inishman writer Dara O'Connell, who now lives in Inishman. And the group devised that novella and made a stage production of it. And we had a successful run with puppets by Pat Bracken, whom I had met at the high side of Nocton's counter in late 1998. He was wearing circular red glasses and he drove a Fanta-coloured Citroen Diane. And of course, Pat came from a long lineage of Dublin stone carvers. He worked with his dad, Stephen. He apprenticed with Stephen and he got his walking papers when it was discovered he was putting grimaces on the Virgin Mary and spectacles on the Sacred Heart. Now, God knows the Sacred Heart should have spectacles, because if he or she did, humanity mightn't be as poorly off as it is today. I mean, look at the Middle East, for example. However, Pat brought a great dimension to the group, a very visual dimension with his puppets, and some of the group members became very proficient at using them. I had come from a theatre background in Kerry with Seamus Satira and Aisteoirí Vrenan in the West Kerry Gaeltacht. So had Marina Ní Chomhain. We were versed in mime. A Catholic priest, Tom Hickey, who was in that part of the world, had trained under Marcel Marceau. And he taught us mime. And so our emphasis was not on the word, even though, ironically enough, we were all fluent Irish speakers. Our emphasis was on the visual, on the lighting, on the puppets, on the movement and that kind of thing. Unchur Alva O'Keefe, who was born in Dunmore, County Galway in 1924, was very favourably disposed to na Fáinne, and she wrote some very florid reviews and always commented on the fluency of the members Irish. Of course, that changed over time as we brought in people with different skills and people that not necessarily spoke the language. So what happened? Well, I think we fell between a number of stools. We were developing a relationship with Phelim Donlan, who was then head of personnel and drama in the Arts Council, and Phelim had come down to see some of our productions. Bord na Gaeilge decided, in their wisdom perhaps, to grant money to Auckland De Hede in Merrion Square. The theatre was based within the Bord na Gaeilge buildings, and that, I think, deflated us to some extent. We were looking for money from Brian na Gaeltachta. Really and truly, Irish arts are a mishmash of funding sources. They come from Brian na Gaeltachta, perhaps from the Arts Council, Furas na Gaeilge, Galway City Council. But the money is small from each source. And if we're serious about producing good work through the medium of the first national language, Article 8 of Bunracht na Héireann, Nádaigh a Trocha Seacht, soon to change, because each party in our parliament is singing on the issue of reunification of our country. And when that happens, perhaps Article 8 will be amended as a concession to the unionists in the northern part of the country, in Northern Ireland. De Valera had done that already in Article 8.2, that Irish would not be forced on any section of the community. And of course, with reunification, many historians and commentators believe that the status of the language will be changed. So it's important that I think we plow ahead and try and establish a firm footing within the Arts Council, which is the obvious place to seek money for theatrical production. Also, many of us became involved in radio and in television. I myself trained in television in 1989 with Udrás na Gaeltachta. I got involved in television in the year subsequent years, although I was still involved with the group to a degree. In 1989, we produced Bully Vorthin, which was set up in the kitchen of this house here with Ray Yates, who was the artistic director of Delt in Dublin, who had come down and we had a workshop, and we met here over tea and toast after coming in from the pub one night, and we struck a deal that we would do a version of the O'Kelleher's short stories, Bullywarthen, from the Cork Gaeltacht. And that was directed by Kazimierz Brown, who was a Polish director, a very successful. It toured the country. It went to the Opera House in Cork, Siam Satira. It went to Dublin. It played at Druid Lane for a week here. And that drew a lot of attention to the group. But as time went on, people were sucked into the hungry machine called the television camera. And of course, you got paid for what you did in television. And so people drifted into television. In 1992, early 1993, three prominent members, Dearma de Fuita, Maureen Ní Chabhán and Audrey Ní Arail, all Munster people, two from West Kerry, one from Ennis, County Clare, they went to work for Ecu Ecu, a new series in RTE. And I think the lure of a decent living from a non-existent living running on fresh air and excitement, you know, it just brought people in. And perhaps to finish, I will quote you a few lines from Jackson Brown. As Christy Moore wrote in his song, you know, Jackson Brown, a 747 just to get him down. They had to build a special runway just to get him down, he wrote, you know. So maybe I'll conclude with a few lines from songwriter Jackson Brown. On the wild and crazy wings of youth, they went flying around in the rain until their feathers, once so fine, were torn and tattered. In the end, they traded their tired wings for the resignation that living brings. They traded love's bright and fragile glow for the glitter and the rouge. In a moment, they were swept before the deluge. Gurumita Mahagan.
It's my own turn now, and my subject is the new theatre in Lombard Street, which opened in the 1830s.
I suppose while we're here, I should point out, in light of what Lorraine was talking about earlier, the Magdalen Asylum, that the first Magdalen Asylum was right here, down beside the lane beside Ryan's home store. It's now part of St. Patrick's School. But anyway, that's not what I'm here to talk about. Brendan earlier spoke about the theatre in Kirwan's Lane, and I suppose the one here on the site of Ryan's home store was the successor, really, to the Kirwan's Lane Theatre. In his History of Galway, published in 1820, James Hardiman wrote about that theatre in Kirwan's Lane, which he stated was, and I'm quoting here, in one of the most confined and inconvenient parts of the town. A new theatre, he continued, is in an open and central situation, appears necessary. When star performers appeared in the Kirwan's Lane stage, such as Sir Edmund Kean in 1824, there was an air of embarrassment, with the Connacht Journal urging on one occasion the play-going gentry should use their every assertion in forwarding the most desirable object, the erection of a new theatre. There were some improvisations, some other efforts, including the provision of a stage in the ballroom of Kilroy's Hotel in 1833. But a purpose-built theatre essentially didn't arise until this theatre opened in 1835. From its advertising, it would appear it was officially known as the Theatre. But inevitably, it was known to Galwegians as the New Theatre. The status of New Theatre was short-lived, however, because we find it referred to in the 1865 Town Commissioner's Minutes as the Old Theatre. In the Ordnance Survey map of 1872, it appears as Theatre in Ruins. As a theatre, then, it had a useful life of 30 or 35 years, a little less than the Kirwan Lane Theatre. The theatre was funded by 70 shareholders who subscribed £10 each. At the start, it was under the management of a Mr. Seymour, who had been putting on shows in Kilroy's Hotel for the previous year or so. We have the following description of the new theatre. The exterior of the theatre is extremely beautiful. The boxes are fitted up with peculiar taste and neatness. The panels of which are ornamented with classic devices and painted a bright salmon colour. The pit is commodious and capable of holding a great number of people. I don't know if you can imagine that from the description. You probably can't, but it does convey a few things. The existence of theatre boxes and of a substantial pit. Arguably, the new theatre democratised theatre going. It had cost 2 shillings and 6 pence to see Edmund Kean in Kirwan's Lane in 1824, and you could have paid as much for a seat in the new theatre. But you could get into the pit for a shilling and into the gallery for less than that. Children paid half price, as did those who arrived in the interval of a double bill performance. The arrangements didn't satisfy all patrons, and it was all too promiscuous for a man who paid top dollar in 1842 and was disconcerted to find himself seated beside a private soldier. A class of persons, he said, who, however personally respectable, are not usually found in that part of any well-conducted theatre. The first performance here was of an operatic play, Rob Roy, about the early 18th century Scottish outlaw and folk hero. Rob Roy MacGregor was also a convert to Catholicism, which may have commended him and his life story indeed to Galway audiences. And while we're on the topic of religion had some bearing on the theatre's history. Protestant evangelicals disapproved of theatre, and this may have been why early advertising for the new theatre emphasised the uplifting character of their offerings, which were far more wholesome, they insisted, than the alternatives, which they defined as the wild mirth of the tavern or the destructive pursuits of the gaming table. To which the evangelical response might have been, well, why don't you stay at home and read your Bibles? For their part, Catholics, even pious Catholics, didn't have any problem with theatre as such. But they were alert to the content of plays and to the message of plays. In 1842, there was a minor controversy about the performance of a staple play called The Warden of Galway, which was concerned with the story of Mayor Lynch's execution of his son. The plot turned on revelations made in confession to a seemingly indiscreet priest. And for one theatre goer, the audience was negligent in not booing the actors off the stage for such a mockery of their clergy and the doctrines of their religion. So we might have had a Playboy riot 60 years before the Playboy riot indeed. One notable actor who appeared here was Ira Aldridge, billed as the African Roscius, and he was reputedly the first black man to play Othello on the London stage. It seems Aldridge was American born, but to advance himself professionally, he created a public persona as the son of a Senegalese prince. The original Roscius was a slave who had been tutor to Cicero and an actor in ancient Rome indeed. Roscius surprised one local critic with his chaste and judicious interpretation of the role of Othello, which he found was, quote, in strict keeping with the Shakespearean character. In the post-famine period, the theatre struggled, as indicated by several changes of management. There was new theatrical fare as well, with minstrel shows featuring white actors in blackface having made their way across the Atlantic to Lombard Street by June 1850. And there was a minor frisson when another American innovation, a woman wearing bloomers, appeared on the stage in 1851. And with that titillating detail, I'll finish and we'll move on to our next stop. We're here at last by the gushing Corrib River. And it's here I'm introducing our final speaker, who is my colleague, Adrian Patterson. Adrian works in the English department at the University of Galway, and he'll tell us about an episode in Galway theatre history
involving a number of key figures of the cultural revival.
We've heard early on today about smoked salmon and salmon pink paint. But as we stand here on the Corrib River in the centre of Galway, I'm going to talk to at the moment about salmon, living salmon, and the effect on theatre. And we have to transport ourselves to a moment in time around the turn of the century, about 120 years ago, on a soft, sunny afternoon in August 1902. Because we're talking about theatre, we've got a cast of characters. All the people I'm talking about are dramatists. They're all from the west of Ireland, all of them in various combinations, collaborators when it comes to writing plays. Our three main characters are W.B. Yeats, who you'll all be familiar with, born in Sligo, well, grew up in Sligo and in London and in Dublin, with a family home, though, in at Tor Ballylee in County Galway. And in 1923, about 100 years ago, he accepted the Nobel Prize in Literature on behalf of the Irish Theatre. At this time, that I'm talking about, he'd only written like two longish but not very popular plays. He's really a kind of minor Victorian poet known for folk stories like The Celtic Twilight and a few lyrics about islands. Our next protagonist, Edward Martin, comes, of course, one of the members of the Tribes of Galway, lives in Tillera Castle in County Galway. He's the only Catholic amongst those I'm talking about today, but he's also the most musical. He's fond of going to Bayreuth to hear Wagner operas. To Italy, he founds the Palestrina Choir in Dublin. And George Moore, who's a good friend of Edward Martin, who's a relative of his, comes from Mayo, but actually is really a creature of London and Paris, where he trains as a painter. And by this time, he's the most famous probably of all of them. He's a novelist and a waspish memoirist, and it's his account in Hail and Farewell that I'm relying on today. There's two more figures that matter, but they're not really center stage. These three Irishmen would be nothing without an Irish woman, Augusta Lady Gregory, who we've heard about earlier on, I think, who is a prime mover, of course, to the Irish Literary Theatre, the Irish National Theatre, and the Abbey Theatre, a member of the Peirce family who own a distillery on what's now university grounds, grows up in Roxburgh House, has a townhouse in Taylor's Hill. Her sister lives on Dominic Street nearby to here. And by marriage to William Gregory, she's the guardian of Cool Park, County Galway, the centre of the revival, where writers and artists come and go like migratory birds, as Yeats describes it. The final figure is Douglas Hyde from County Roscommon, president of the Gaelic League and later of Ireland. He's an academic, author of The Love Songs of Connacht, and writes plays in Irish, often to scenarios by Gregory and Yeats, based on local stories or songs. And at this time, they're all collaborators, and the collaborations are mostly amicable, if at times a bit farcical. Travelling west on the train with Yeats and Augusta Gregory, Moore remembers the pleasure I took in their soft Western accents. And at this moment, they kind of give each other credit for the work that they do. So, for instance, Hyde writes to Lady Gregory, "When they're not Yeats's, they're really yours," talking about the plays that they're working on together. And it becomes a bit more strained. So staying in his Tillera Castle house in Galway, Yeats and Moore, for instance, impolitely rewrite Edward Martin's work. And at least according to those two, he didn't have a major talent for playwriting. And honorably but reluctantly, he gives over his play, The Tale of the Town, to Moore and to Yeats to be dismembered. Moore remembers saying to Yeats, "You see, you'll have to help me with this adaptation, for I know nothing of Ireland." But he also says, "It's a pleasure to be with Yeats. He's a real man of letters with an intelligence as keen as a knife." And a knife was required to cut the knots into which Edward had tied his play. So at this time, Yeats and Moore are also struggling with a heroic play called Dermot and Gronje. I think we heard earlier today about the subject becoming an Irish language play later on for Antiviach. But the subject is something that they're working together with. They try to do all sorts of things to make this sound the right kind of thing, sound heroic enough. They put the text into French and then back into English in order to free it of stylistic mannerisms, which of course sounds essentially completely lunatic. Only you might say that they're doing similar things with Hyde's Irish language plays, like Casa an Tugan, based on an Irish song and story, which is then becomes an English scenario, put into Irish by Douglas Hyde and then actually translated back into English as the twisting of the rope. So these kind of language complications, I think, part very much of what's going on at this point. And you might say even someone like Samuel Beckett, when he puts plays in French and then back into English, is doing something not completely different. Anyway, these plays become, Dermot and Gronje and Casagrande and Sugon become a kind of success when they play together in Dublin at the same time, to music by Edward Elgar, and J.M. Singh is in the audience, and thinks that this is the moment where, if you like, the Irish literary revival begins. This following year, in 1902, George Moore comes to Galway town for the August Fesh, and he's looking for Irish translators for his work, his short stories particularly. And if you want to know more about that Fesh, which I'll talk about a bit, Adrian Fraser's article in John Cunningham's book about Galway is perhaps the place to go. Anyway, we have in situ Douglas Hyde, who is rehearsing with school children another of these collaborative plays called On Posset, The Marriage, featuring himself as the blind poet Anthony Raftery and his wonderful moustaches, which kind of expressed the exuberance by which he plays these things. And it's put on at the town hall with Yeats and Gregory in attendance. Edward Martin's in town because he's a judge of the Fesh Ceoil, the music competition, where Sean Noe singers and others also taking place in the town hall with initial rounds at the St. Patrick's Temperance Hall in Forster Street. And on this particular day in August, they're waiting for these musicians, more musicians and storytellers, to arrive from Aaron, a young storyteller in the Irish language called Mary Folan, and several other names in Irish, but Mary Folan is the name they use, and a piper coming from the Middle Island, meaning Inishman. And I'm told by my sources that pipers, it probably is not a native piper from the island, it's one of the travelling pipers. Anyway, they're waiting in Galway town, but, says Yeats, they should be here by now, but there is no wind in the bay, it's very still, as well as being warm. So Augusta Gregory lets the boys off for the afternoon. Particularly Yeats has to go and check that he's allowed to go off, so they do that. And Yeats and Martin and Moore, our three protagonists, go for an idle afternoon walk through the town, on which walk they all display, let's say, different but characteristic appetites for, well, nature and music and sexual appetites as well, let's say. So George Moore says he wants to see the salmon in the corrib. He says, all my life I've heard of the salmon lying in the river 4 and 5 deep like sardines in a box. And they join other idlers, also enjoying the fair weather, their arms resting on the stone bridge. Except that the river's really low. No one had ever seen it lower at this time. And the fish, therefore, have to wait a long enough time to get enough water to go up the weir where they spawn. Moore says, my eyes could not distinguish a fish till Yeats told me to look straight down through the brown water. And I saw one, and immediately afterwards, a second, a third, and a fourth. And then the great shoal, hundreds, thousands of salmon, each fish keeping its place in the current, a slight movement of the tail being sufficient. And he says Yeats is a bit of a naturalist, and he tells them about the spawning of the salmon, the habits of the salmon, which only feed in the sea. So at this point, they're not feeding. And if any fisherman is to get a rise, it's because basically the salmon are bored of waiting and snap at anything to relieve the tedium. And so they watch at this, you know, lovely August sunny day, a single fisherman who arrives on the bank who keeps throwing his line in, casting, but in vain. And there's sort of the salmon aren't biting. And on the other bank from here, there were waste places, says Moore, difficult to account for, ruins showing dimly through the soft, diffused light like old castles. But Yeats said there were the ruins of ancient mills, for Galway was once a prosperous town, which I guess suggests in 1902 it's not so much. Anyway, they stay watching this fisherman doing this kind of dance of skill and patience, who finally lands one of the salmon, a kind of, you know, patience and expertise that Yeats will later immortalize in verse that I'll read out at the end. Anyway, at this moment they do a little tour through the town, past the Martin family house, where he says, my ancestors must have danced in Galway, there being no important town in Mayo, that minuets and gavottes or waltz, which gets on the subject of music. They go past St. Nicholas's Church, where Martin remembers, called on us to remember, he says, there could not have been much culture in Galway in the 15th century, yet Galway could still build a cathedral. I think he's making an implicit contrast to that moment, to that 1902 moment. Martin is, of course, the prime mover behind Loughrea Cathedral, and the Celtic Revival interior, which he partly commissions and funds and uses the Yeats family to design, yet Jack B. Yeats and others are involved in this. Anyway, at this Fesh, It might be interesting to note, I suppose, that how few of the town's notables and nobody from the university attends a single day, a single event at this fesh. Although these are kind of, in some cases, genuinely aristocratic, in other cases, you know, middle-class figures, the Irish Revival is doing something interesting. It puts into direct contact, for instance, the Irish and the English languages, European and Irish myths, English arts and crafts revival with local craft, Protestants and Catholics, of course, and particularly here, local traditional culture with a kind of subset of intellectual classes, these playwrights. Anyway, all these three playwrights cross the bridge and head down to the Cladder, where they find yellow-skinned boys basking among the brown nets along the Great Wharf, boys using both Irish and English. And Edward Martin's not sure about this. He says that's how a language dies. The parents speak it, the children understand it, but don't speak it, and the grandchildren neither speak nor understand. I like the English language and I like the Irish, he says, but I hate the mixture. Anyway, perhaps impatient by this very serious talk of music and language and culture, and noting that next to his teetotal and celibate cousin, George Moore is, well, he says by Edward, one is always safe from adventures. So George Moore kind of slips off and carries on ahead down some yards. And there he finds, of course, a typical kind of exciting encounter. In a bay, the other side of Nimmo's pier wall, you know, I was talking to John about this, and there's a lot more bay, a lot more water out there than there is now, which has become reclaimed land in a park anyway. But somewhere on the other side of Nimmo's pier is a bay in which three girls have drawn off their shoes and stockings and advance into the water. On seeing me, says George Moore, they laughed invitingly, as if desiring my appreciation. One girl walked across the pool, lifting her red petticoat to her waist and forgetting to drop it when the water shallowed, showing me thighs whiter and rounder than any I have ever seen. Okay. So there's a wonderful kind of perhaps half imaginary sexual frisson, because Moore imagines that if you could just stay there a bit longer, they might invite him in and they'd have a wonderful frolic in the water. This is, I think, characteristic of what Moore's interested in when it comes to even the west of Ireland, characteristic of his appetites. And he's almost disappointed then when the others call to him, because the arrival of the hooker being rowed up the bay, bringing the piper and the storytellers from Arran, means his little reverie is over. And it might be worth saying, I suppose, that the day contains seeds for the future. Actually, in some way, well, what passes for anecdote among the rich becomes legend among the poor is a kind of axiom of Yeats's. And in some ways, these anecdotes perhaps become, in their own way, legendary. Moore, of course, George Moore moves to Dublin, takes up the cause very violently of the cultural revival, even of the Irish language and art, and keeps writing plays, but falls out with Yeats over a collaboration and play scenario, really becomes confirmed again as a novelist and writes those memoirs, Hail and Farewell. But it's possible that, for instance, that dreamy water encounter on the pier feeds into that famous incident in James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, where Stephen Dedalus encounters a bird girl wading in the sea, her dress drawn up. Not sure about that, but the dates would work. At least Moore has published that story by the time Joyce writes the book, so you never know. Edward Martin, of course, actually secedes from the Abbey because, as a good Catholic, he thinks they're playing improper plays, which, if you can hear George Moore's interest, I'm not surprised, I suppose. He's still very much invested in the Irish language and particularly music, and, you know, creates all sorts of musical things for Loughrea Cathedral and other things, and keeps going to Wagner every year in Bayreuth, and keeps being active in the cultural life until he's incapacitated by a stroke around about the time of the Civil War. Yeats, of course, eventually wins the Nobel Prize and pursues his combined interest, I think, in fish and theatre. He writes plays the rest of his life. He becomes, with Augusta Gregory and with J.M. Singh, the pillars of the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, and also writes a really interesting poem, which I'll end with, called The Fisherman. In despair of the audience of his plays, also Singh's plays particularly, we're getting in Dublin, the kind of indifference and vitriol that he encounters at some play performances in Dublin, he imagines returning west and finding there a single solitary audience in a fisherman of Connemara, and says in an early version of the poem, "But there is one that I can see always, though he's not yet born. He walks by the edge of the stream in a good homespun coat and carries a fishing rod in his hand." And this figure appears finally when he rewrites the poem to be called The Fisherman, which celebrates the skill, this knack of fishermen from Galway and Connemara, which kind of creates almost from nothing, but perhaps from this incident in 1902, the ideal audience for poems and plays. you have to get up early if you want to catch Yeats catching fish, and this is the close of the poem. Maybe a 12 months since, suddenly, I began in scorn of this audience, by which he means the Dublin town audience, imagining a man and his sun freckled face and grey Connemara cloth, climbing up to a place where stone is dark with froth, and the downturn of his wrist when the flies drop in the stream. A man who does not exist, a man who is but a dream, and cried, before I'm old, I shall have written him one poem, maybe as cold and passionate as the dawn.
Very good.